everyone, and welcome to a very long titled panel, but it's covering a lot, so it's got a long title. And this title is The Twice Crowned Queen, The Kingmaker, and The Prince Without a Kingdom or a Throne, potentially, to be seen. And this is all in relation to three fascinating characters that have been recently revived and slightly rewritten to a great extent in some cases, in the Netflix series Vikings Valhalla, which is focused on the 11th century conflicts and throne swapping and throne taking, etc., in between Norway, Denmark, and of course Anglo-Saxon England at the time, and a bit of Normandy too. The characters involved are Godwin, Earl of Sussex, or formerly of Sussex, or Wessex, sorry. I'm getting my timeline a bit confused according to Netflix's wonderful interpretation of history. Emma of Normandy, who is of Normandy, but she married one king, but then married on to a second king, and she actually gave birth to two kings of England, so she's got quite a lot of weight in the English lineage on the throne. And of course, Harald Hardrada, but he's not Hardrada in this series because he hasn't earned that great title yet. He's currently just known as Harald Sigurdsson, i.e. the son of Sigurd. And his wonderful adventures and that kind of thing. And I'm delighted to say I'm welcomed by three greatly respected and much adored guests on my panel. I have got authors Justin Hill of Shieldwall and Viking Fire. Do go buy them. They're great books. I've also got author Patricia Bracewell, who's written a wonderful trilogy about Emma of Normandy, starting with Shadow on the Crown, another great series. Please go buy it. And wonderful historian who's just finished another book and published a new one as we speak, Sharon. I'm going to get your name wrong again, Sharon. Please correct me. Is it Connolly Bennett or Bennett Connolly?
Bennett Connolly.
Bennett Connolly. Right. I wasn't sure whether to believe the text on my screen at the time because I got it wrong last time you guessed it. I do apologise, but thank you for correcting me. You don't want to know how long my name is in its full entirety, and everyone gets it confused. These three wonderful people have joined me to discuss the latest series of Netflix Vikings Valhalla. It's got its second season out. It came out in January, and it follows a lot of these three characters. A good 50% is Harald Sigurdsson stuff, with another 50% Godwin and Emma kind of stuff. But we're here to help you, dear viewers, whether you've seen the series or not, to learn the truth. And the truth is far better than the fiction. Trust me, it really, 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 really is.
Unless it's our fiction.
Yes, of course it's your fiction. I mean, their fiction is a lot better as well than the series. A bit more truthful, if not say a good lot more truthful, more respectful for the actual history that occurred. Because Netflix has a wonderful thing. It's a bit like Harry Potter in that the unbelievable happens, in that characters that were dead at the time are alive and kicking and getting muddled up in other people's timelines. It's a bit like historical Doctor Who. Everyone's mixed up. No one's really on the right planet or timeline of existence at all. So to begin with, I think we should start with one of the characters that many people probably don't think of that much. And Patricia, you may well think, oh, that might be Queen Emma. But actually, I think it's Godwin of Wessex, because everyone knows his son, Harald Godwinson, who became the Anglo-Saxon king. You had to face off Hardrada and then face off William the Conqueror. I nearly forgot his name. My memory is a bit addled, but it's holding. But how Godwin became in his position at the royal court under both Ethelred, famously the Unready, and then of course under Canute, who became Emma's second kingly husband, and thus she became queen twice over, in my opinion. So we actually have in our panel Justin Hill, who wrote a wonderful book about Godwin, Shieldwall. Would you be able to give us maybe a brief explanation of Godwin's position within Ethelred's court at the time?
Yeah, I'm not sure he has much of a position in Ethelred's court.
It's good to know.
I mean, I think Godwin is mysterious. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here is quite mysterious because the sources we have often don't tell us information we want. They are often kind of written maybe 100 years or more after the events. And they're looking at the events in the sense of kind of a... looking at events that happened as instruments of kind of God's will. So they're explaining things in a way that show that, you know, God's will was enacted upon the, you know, people. The Battle of Hastings was a judgment upon Harold Godwinson, for example. So our sources are kind of hazy and sometimes misleading. So my kind of take on Godwin is largely from Frank Barlow's book about the Godwins, and him looking at the sources and kind of guessing, but very informed guesses. We have to sort of think our way back into the state of Ethelred the Unready's reign, where England, or kind of a Wessex kingdom, has united the various parts of England, and that kind of kingdom is slowly being worn down by a series of Viking invasions, with the kings of Denmark kind of getting increasingly centralized and powerful and coming over in ever larger armies, with a change from just exhorting Danegeld from the English kingdom to Svein Forbit deciding he's actually going to conquer England. And in this kind of mess and melee, English, what I think is quite interesting is the kind of the English, and here again we're kind of limited by the language we use, and that what we think of English is not necessarily what they think of English. English is a collection of kind of kingdoms that have been united, and within that you get many different peoples, or tribes, if you like. You have the West Saxons, the South Saxons, you have kind of Danegeld, which has been heavily influenced by the Danish settlers from the previous century. And all the kind of loyalties to the English throne get kind of tested. And what is, I think, really impressive is actually how well England stays together. If you think of these Danish settlers in the Danegeld, and the Danegeld is kind of the Midlands of England. It takes a lot for them to kind of go over to Svein Forkbeard. And so in this kind of, in the latter years of Ethelred's reign, essentially you have Ethelred is not fighting for the kingdom. Svein Forkbeard or Canute are going around the country and extorting oaths from people, otherwise they're going to have their lands devastated and their halls burnt, etc. And so you have people kind of switching sides continually, in just a kind of mess of civil war, really, and sort of vendettas. And from this kind of this mess, Ethelred is kind of was always inept, his kind of younger son, Edmund Ironside, or later becomes known as Edmund Ironside, eventually kind of rebels against his father and starts to wage war against the Vikings. And from this kind of chaotic mess, Godwin appears, and we don't really know where he comes from or why, but I think there are hints of who he is. And the most likely explanation is that his father is a kind of a minor South Saxon thane called Wulfnoth, Wulfnoth Kill, which translates directly as Wulfnoth the Child, which I kind of thought, how would you translate that? I kind of thought Wulfnoth the
Younger.
Bad.
Yeah. Like the younger.
Yeah, or kind of, he's a kind of a hero in some sense. He's got a kind of a nomiker, a nickname. So Frank Barlow's kind of theory is that he's been one of the more successful thanes in defending his lands from the Vikings. And I think he appears in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle in 1008 or 1009, when there's a big gathering of a naval fleet at Sandwich, I think. And in the kind of civil war, Wulfnoth is accused of something. We don't know what exactly. He persuades 20 crews to run away with him, and then the rest of the fleet go in pursuit. As he's sailing in his own kind of waters, he survives a storm. The rest of the fleet does not, is kind of scattered and shipwrecked, and the whole effort of raising this huge fleet is kind of wasted. And the link between Wulfnoth killed and in Godwin is in the will of Ethelred's eldest son, Athelstan, who dies before Ethelred. And in there, in the will, he mentions that he returns the manor of Compton to Godwin, son of Wulfnoth. And so this is probably an estate that's been confiscated since Wulfnoth was exiled, and then ends up with Godwin. And so from this kind of mess Godwin appears, and it's, I'd love to know what you two think, Shun and Sharon, of where Godwin comes from.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. I think that he was probably part of Edmund's entourage, maybe Athelstan's entourage at first, and then Edmund's. There's a story that in 1015, Canute was crowned in the south. One of the bishops supposedly crowned him king, and when the south submitted to him in early 1015. And I was wondering if perhaps Godwin was part of that group. This was before Asendon. And I went back and I looked, and Godwin signs more charters in 1018 than any other elderman, any other thane, including the Danish ones. So he was part of Canute's entourage, followers, from very early on. And it may have been because of what happened down there in southern Wessex. In early 1015. What do you think, Sharon?
It sounds quite likely, and it may well be that he had been part of Athelstan's household, but then when Athelstan died, he went over to Canute. I mean, there was, well, Athelstan died in 1014, didn't he? And Canute lost power about the same time. So it may be that when Canute came back, that he sided with Canute, because the thing is, because we don't know anything before then about Godwin, he might have had a falling out with Edmund years ago, you know. He might have been that Edmund and Athelstan didn't get on at one stage, and there's so much that we don't know that you can be really inventive.
That's right. This whole time of history is so, there's so many gaps that it makes it just, fictionalized fiction writers and screenwriters can just throw all kinds of stuff in there. And
for me, I have to put either or every time. Well, it could have been this, or it could have been that. Luckily, I can leave it to the reader to make their own minds up and just give them all the possibilities, or say what I think is most likely. But with this, we don't even have enough to say what was most likely. We know that his dad was accused of treason by Brittrig, but we don't know what the treason was. We know that Athelstan left him his father's estate, so he must have got on well with Athelstan, and he must have served Athelstan well for Athelstan to do that. But what he did between 1014, when Athelstan died, and 1018, when suddenly he's signing all these charters for Canute, we don't know. But he must have taken sides with Canute at some stage for him to be so quickly so valuable to Canute.
And this is where Netflix, unfortunately, have tried almost to write his story, but without knowing a lot, if anything, because he was around in the first season when we briefly, ever so briefly, meet Ethelred the Unready, who dies within two episodes, if not the first one. He's shown to be some kind of courtier when Emma's trying to take the control and fend off the Vikings. Unfortunately, and I'm sorry if I'm going to spoil this for anyone watching, Godwin was not the enemy. He did not murder Edmund. He did not betray Edmund in any way, sense or form. Godwin, according to history, is quite loyal. He's quite good at strategic. And I think the one aspect that they have caught of his character, which seems to be reflecting what you guys are saying, is, I think he even says it in the series, kind of like, he's a survivalist. He's a survivor. Mm. He does what he needs to survive. Even in the series, if it's killing off one king to befriend another kind of thing. And I guess if you have had your family kind of hugely dishonoured and your land and rights taken from you, you are kind of like left politically and socially vulnerable in that sense. So to have done what he's done, to keep moving in circles, to even get close to being of good use to any kings or princes to be, that kind of thing, is interesting. I'm glad you brought up, Justin, about his father and what he possibly or possibly did not do in terms of the treason, because he does, in the series, allude to it, to his wife to be, who is, I'm sorry, spoilers, gets lobbed again. Unfortunately, Godwin's setting a trait for lobbing off people. He alludes to it, but he doesn't ever say what. He just says, oh, I've kind of like, I want to focus on my future. I don't want to think about my father and his past. And no.
Because we don't know. So
yeah.
He doesn't know. So instead of making up something, they just allude to it.
Yeah. Well, I guess that one aspect is true.
What we can say about Godwin is that he's clearly very successful, because he manages to stay. He kind of rises very rapidly under Canute, and then remains for the rest of his life, an absolute power broker in the country, and installs, you know, his sons across England. My hunch with Godwin, kind of just thinking about the characters, was how does he rise to power? There's a story, and I think is it William Malmesbury who talks about. He saves someone from a battle and then kind of rises that way. But my hunch was, Canute is a 17-year-old lad when he becomes King of England, and he's a bit like Alexander the Great, who's inherited an army of kind of hardened, dour professionals who won't necessarily want to listen to a 17-year-old lad. The Viking army and the English army have traipsed around England, you know, taking oaths from the same warlords who promised to, you know, support them. So everyone's broken their everyone has broken their oaths by this point. So Canute comes to a country where everyone's lied to him, or everyone has kind of betrayed him, he doesn't necessarily trust, you know, the kind of the big guys upon whom he's, you know, his own kind of Viking commanders. And so my hunch was, if Godwin stayed loyal to Edmund Ironside, then that's someone Canute knows he can trust. And the idea of trust was quite interesting to me, because in one of his first charters, Canute, when he becomes King of England, Canute raises the penalties for oath breaking. So this sense of oath breaking or disloyalty is clearly something that is kind of is in his mind when he becomes king in England.
I can imagine, and I suppose this is harking back to season one a bit, the infamous villainous, more villainous than Godwin in the series, Earl of Striona, is a proper villain compared to how the series are depicting Godwin. They've kind of completely got the roles reversed, unfortunately. And I'll always remember kind of like reading my wonderful books on Canute about how Canute had Striona beheaded and say, well, let's show you how we treat oath breakers and those who betray their oaths to their king, that kind of thing. Here you go, off your head, and off he dropped. And I actually cheered when I read that. I was like, yes, he's finally done it, because after reading the accounts of how he switched sides so many times between Ethelred, then Canute, then Edmund, then back to Ethelred, then Canute, I can like get that, how that was a real big push for Canute to say, right, everyone's loyal to me or else, basically.
Yeah. Well, they seem to be following a lot of kind of Norman sources want to blacken Godwin, because he's obviously the father of Harold Godwin's son,
who's William's
major rivals. And so if you can smear Godwin, then you smear his son as well.
That's a very good point. Never considered that. Because, of course, a lot of the viewers of these series might not have read much historical non-fiction, or have even covered this period in any history that they might have had educationally. And of course, it all comes from sources. All our educational teaching and all your research from you wonderful people comes from sources. And if the sources are biased, then we're not really getting we're only getting a half truth, if anything. So that's a very good point.
The sources are always biased, because whenever you write, you have an agenda. So they're always biased in some direction. It's trying to figure that out is the key.
Yeah. And somebody certainly didn't read the one that said that Godwin was loyal to Emma.
Oh, yes, that's a big thing in season two.
Yeah.
And that brings me actually, because of course you mentioned about how quickly he rose through the ranks, Justin, because of course in season two, we see through a very almost Macbeth style plot how Godwin eventually obtains the hand of Geatha. Now, you ladies may be able to clarify, because, of course, in the series, she's referred to as Canute's niece. I don't think she's a blood relative, is she?
No, she isn't.
No.
Her brother is married to Canute's sister.
Ah, cool.
So in one of the, in, I can't remember which one, but in one of the sources, she's referred to as Canute's sister, but she isn't. She's Canute's brother-in-law's sister.
Too much of a mouthful, part really. Of his wider kin group. She was part of his wider kin
group. The extended royal family.
Was bringing Godwin sort of into that family grouping, but not blood. And so that, you know, the line of the hierarchy that leads you to a kingship, that wasn't there.
Yeah.
She was not a blood relative.
No.
And because they get that wrong.
Because of her relationship with Canute, Canute's sister's son, who is therefore Githa's nephew, does become king of Denmark. So, you know, they are semi-royal. And it's not who you know. She definitely knew everybody. So it was definitely a step up for Godwin to be able to marry someone like Githa.
Which is why the television show, which has him proposing marriage to one of Emma's handmaidens, is utterly ridiculous. He would never have done that. He would have wanted to marry up. He would have wanted to marry into the elite, into the nobility.
Although I did wonder if they did that, because there is a suggestion that Githa was his second wife. Ooh. And there was this woman, is it Thyra or Thura, who apparently was a slave trader. And in some of the chronicles, it suggests that they were married first and she died. And then he married Githa. But there seems to be some confusion, you know, it's not certain. Mm. And there's a story that they had a son, him and this first wife, who rode his horse into the Thames and drowned.
As you do.
And I think the matter of kind of one wife is also a bit more fluid at this time.
Yes.
You know, there wasn't strict monogamy.
I mean, Canute famously had two wives, one Emma and then one Elgifu of Northampton.
Yeah.
Harold II did. And Harold Sigurdsson, Harold Hardrada, he had two wives at the same time as well. It was seems to be a common practice, common theme throughout the 1066 story, two wives at the same time.
Well, given the era and troubling times that these people all lived through, I can understand the men wanting to put as many eggs in as many baskets as they could to kind of strengthen their survival kind of thing.
So
that's good. We've clarified there wasn't a direct niece. She was further down the family tree. But I guess that's where the creative license is allowed in order to kind of like make Godwin's big dream of having his firstborn son eventually become King of England. And he does say this in the series, Justin. He's very open to his now dead fiance about his political ambition. Because, of course, if you tell the dead, then they can't tell anyone.
I don't think he ever would have had that ambition at the time, though. No. I think that would have been so far above him. No. He would never, ever have expected one of his children to become King of England.
No.
And it wasn't his eldest son, was it? Wasn't Sven
Sven was the eldest son.
Well, he clearly didn't, because he has his daughter marry Edward the Confessor. Edward. So his kind of his dynastic ambition is through his daughter, not through his sons.
Yeah. Yeah, he was looking at having a grandson on the throne, which didn't work out very well considering Edward the Confessor, but
And this brings me right round to our second kind of like intriguing character, the twice crowned Queen Emma, because of course Emma must have been in the same circles, groups, possibly the same room as Godwin during this time, because if Godwin was around with her first husband's sons, then she would have observed him doing this and doing that. And then I often wondered, obviously, watching season two, whether historically Emma had any input to Canute say, oh, you want to keep that one, he's a good one. As in, like, who to keep in court and who not to keep in court kind of thing. Or whether it was just purely Godwin's own merit and efforts that helped him stay. Because, of course, Emma was trying to help Canute balance the shifting... what's the word I'm looking for? Shifting power control between like the Vikings and the Saxons, because in series Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible. When Canute married Emma in 1017, a big part of it was to get the English on his side, to show the continuity and to get the ones who supported the English, you know, to give them a reason to come over to his side. If he's, if he's married to the Queen of England, then everybody else has a reason, has an excuse to actually go, oh, actually, yeah, okay, then I'll swear to him. And it gives them a way out.
Yeah, it's hard to just appreciate what an extraordinary marriage this is, because she's probably a good 10 years older than him, has two sons already by the Ethelred the Unready. And he could kind of pick any noblewoman, you know, around, and he picks Emma. So that's, it's really quite an extraordinary marriage. So it says,
does she pick him? That's what I like to think.
Well, no, he sent for her.
Yeah, it says an extraordinary amount about Emma that that Canute wants to marry her, and that her marriage is so important to him. So, and you know, through that we know that she is really quite an extraordinary character.
She is, absolutely.
And she saw herself as a peace weaver. That's how she presents herself in the encomium, that she's the one that actually brings peace to England through this marriage. And I believe that that's what she believed. So it's important. And she would have known all the nobles. She would have known the church hierarchy. She would have known how the administration was handled, the laws. We see her signing charters, you know. So she was deeply involved in what happened in England in Canute's reign.
And you could imagine her actually negotiating with Canute when he said, I want you to be my wife, and her saying, well, Ethelred didn't let me do anything. I want to be able to, you know, you want me to bring these English nobles with me, then I want to be able to have a say and at least be listened to. And then you find out that when Canute dies, his son Harold Harefoot has to send his troops to Winchester to collect the treasury, because Emma was so important to Canute that she actually let him hold the money. But it's just a great way of demonstrating how important Emma was to Canute's reign.
I think there's one of your questions was about that marriage, Rebecca, and it was not unusual for a conqueror at that time to marry the widow of the enemy that he's conquered. That was not unusual. Svenborg did it. Yeah, back then it was, I think it probably happened in Scotland.
Yeah, it did. Macbeth married the widow of somebody who...
Brooke. He married Brooke.
Gil Comgaine, who miraculously somehow got burned to death, possibly at Macbeth's hand, and then she married Macbeth. So, yeah, it was...
Okay. So if... I'm often trying to wonder kind of like what... And you guys may or may not know, depending on all the dates of your research, kind of like what the age difference might have been between Emma and Godwin. Kind of like, were they kind of like parallel in age, or were the one slightly older, slightly younger? Because, of course, Godwin was around as a young man, I presume, at the same time as Æthelstan and Edmund. But, of course, Emma was quite young when she married Æthelred the Unready. So I don't know whether...
Emma and Godwin probably were...
Similar,
between 5 and 10 years of each other. I don't think there was would have been much of an age difference.
I think she'd be older than him. Because she's been King of England since the early 1002. She becomes queen.
Yeah, 1002. She was probably about 13 or 14 then.
They died within a year of each other, didn't they? She died in 1052, and I think he was right he around that same time.
That's a tragic note. Oh, well, hopefully they were a lot more amicable towards each other than they are in the series.
I think for a certain amount of time, their interests would have been very similarly aligned. I think in many ways, they're both survivors and they're both kind of powerful people who
are good at staying in control. And, you know, many times they were very similarly aligned. I mean, they were both behind Canute and they were both kind of stalwarts supporting him.
They seem to have, they weren't aligned during the reign of Harold Harefoot.
No.
Because Emma wanted her son Arthur Canute to be king and Godwin was on, Harold Harefoot was the king actually here in England. So he supported Harold.
Interesting.
For a time, I think he supported Canute at first, but then when Canute didn't, sorry, Arthur Canute didn't come back from Denmark to claim the throne, he decided he'd better be in his best interest to be with the king who was actually on hand rather than the king over the water. It would have got a bit complicated for him if he carried on supporting Arthur Canute. He'd look like the enemy as far as Harold Harefoot was concerned. So sensibly,
He was stuck at between a rock and a hard place there. They had to make a decision. And once, you know, once Harold Harefoot was accepted as King of England, there was nothing that he could do. And of course, Emma's sons coming over from Normandy only added chaos to what was going on. But we're not there yet in this story.
I can't wait to see how they handle that one.
I'm not sure they will. You know, one thing about the show is they don't. Emma had two children by Canute. We don't see those kids anywhere in Valhalla. She would have been busy getting, you know, raising two young children.
Yeah.
So we don't see that at all in this show, and I don't know how they're going to handle it farther on.
Am I correct in thinking that when she married Canute, didn't her sons, well, I say sons, because Alfred obviously sadly had his eyes put out and then died. But Edmund, he stayed in Normandy when she came back and then eventually married Canute. But of course, in the end of season one, the two sons are still around there. They're not, both are alive and both are in Winchester.
Yeah, well, in season one, they go with their uncle to Normandy and then we don't see them anymore. And they're gone. And of course, Alfred, when he came over, that was not until after Canute was dead. So no, both sons are in Normandy, as is their sister, Godgifu. So she's there and they're being taken care of. Meantime, Emma's having two children by Canute over in England. So, but we don't, you know, they've been totally forgotten. Whereas Elfgifu, Canute's first wife, we see her with her two sons in Norway, which is where they actually were.
Yes, it's going to be interesting seeing how Norway eventually turns against Elgifu now that they've finally got rid of Harald's half-brother, Olaf. And that's another character that needs a whole other episode to pick.
Yeah, that's another timeline apparition.
So this is, you can see, why, dear Runa, why we're talking to all these wonderful people to try and nitpick and unpick the wonderful thing that is Netflix history versus the real history, which itself is an equally dramatic tangle and more dramatic than any series could really do justice for. What else were my questions? Let me think about my questions. I've got so many. I had so many. Where are they? There's one. So that was interesting. That was the thing. So in season two, Justin, Godwin plays a bit of a kind of a torturer, a kind of like bully questioner. He's got some poor bloke strapped to a chair, having his eyes put out, saying, "So you hate the Vikings, everyone he does. Why were you trying to assassinate the Queen?" It was a really bad failed attempt on assassinating the Queen. It did make me wonder, actually, because you don't often see that in this particular series, at least, although it has been, I've noted, depicted quite well in The Last Kingdom, which is another great historical series, which is slightly better at telling the truth than this one. Sorry, Netflix, you're just messing with it too much. How much friction there might have been amongst population as the Vikings kind of claimed lands, claimed titles and settled, and the whole court became kind of like Anglo-Danish kind of thing. And was there any friction at the noble society level, do you think? Because of course people would have lost sons in the wars, lost their titles.
My sense is that the pain of Ethelred's reign really disenfranchised or killed most of the
aristocracy, of the old aristocracy. And so in a sense, you have a country kind of coming out of a civil war situation where the kind of the old elites have been discredited or killed, and you have a new kind of vigorous and successful Anglo-Danish aristocracy coming in. And in a sense, Godwin is absolutely part of that. I mean, he's married a Danish kind of princess. Look at the way he names his children. His first children are named Svein, Harald, Tosti. These are all Viking names. And it's not until Canute dies that his children start getting English names. So you can see a kind of, England is the kind of the center of a kind of an Anglo-Danish or a Nordic a kingdom. And I think a lot of the great Skaldic poets come to England because the best or the richest king who is going to reward you is Canute. So England becomes, Winchester becomes the center of Skaldic poetry. You have kind of Danish, like Bjorn comes down to England again. So I think this idea of friction or kind of racial friction between Danes and Saxons is really, it's looking at it in a kind of a 21st century way that I think is probably largely inaccurate. I imagine that actually it may well have been friction, but again, England had been settled by Vikings for over 100 years by this point, a large parts of it, and so yeah, I think that's kind of artistic license.
Can I add to that? I think that Knut tried to address that, because some of his first laws dealt with dealing with widows and their problems and land tenure, because so many of the elite would have died. And the letter that he wrote back to England, I guess it was in 1020, he went to Denmark, is written in English. His letters are in English. They're not Latin, they're not Danish, they're in English. And so he's trying to bind the wounds of that kingdom. And I think we have to accept that England was almost half Danish and half Saxon. And so he's got to bring that together. And of course, that it's reflected in the elite and the Witan, which becomes Anglo-Danish.
Yeah, and he was sensible in a way. I mean, people who talk of the English don't like it, but he did put, I think it was four earls, four of his own people he put in place as earls in Northumbria and throughout the country. So he basically split the country into four for government by his people, and then everybody else was under them. So, which is, it's sensible. You've conquered a land. Yeah. You're going to put your own people in charge. But yeah, that is then, just slowly spreads down through the ranks. But they're going to keep a tight rein at the beginning until people get used to it. See with Canute's reign, it is incredibly peaceful.
It is.
Compared to Ethelred's beforehand and compared to what happens in 1066, Canute's reign is a period of stability for about from 1018 onwards. He can go to Denmark and deal with Denmark, because England is secure and at peace.
Yeah, I think the idea that it's an English state that falls in 1066 is a misnomer. I mean, Sharon talks about the earls. Earl is a Viking title that Canute brings in. The kind of the symbol we have of Anglo-Saxon England is the Huscarl fighting in the Shield Wall. And again, this is a Scandinavian name for a kind of Scandinavian rank that rises, during this time. So it's an Anglo-Danish state really that falls in 1066. Godwin, Harald Godwinson, again, he's a Viking name. His mother is a Viking, and he probably grew up speaking Danish as much as English.
And you have to look at England as well. It had only been England since 938. 937? I can't remember when the Battle of Brunanburh was.
937 or 38.
I only watched The Last Kingdom the other night, and I can't remember.
I only watched it this morning.
You know, it was only the 930s that it was all united as one kingdom. So it was still very young as a country.
And even that didn't last. And even that didn't last out under Athelstan. It wasn't until Edgar, Ethelred's father, became king that it was completely united. So that was like 940 or something, 970. I can't remember the date. It was later. It was later.
Yeah,
I wanted to point out that, you know, for the average person in England, you know, your little guy Unferth, for him, his loyalty was to his immediate lord. Mm. And so whoever was way up on top as king, that didn't impact, you know, England was still quite tribal. It didn't impact him, except for maybe taxes and when he had to go fight, when he was called to battle, but it still, that was coming from his lord. He, whoever the king was, didn't have that big an impact, I don't think, on the average Joe.
And I have to say, where I live, I actually live in the Danelaw, so we'd have been probably quite happy that Canute was on the
Yeah, because this is the thing, a lot of viewers might have forgotten that. That just like over 100 or so years previously, isn't it? Or maybe 200 years previously, the Danelaw was formed, so half of England already became Danish to a degree. It was like a test run before Canute then came over. And of course, Canute is sadly the forgotten king of England. You don't ever learn about him in the history books at school, or I didn't anyway. But that's just my own personal educational history. Some people might have done, depending on the generation or what school they went to.
My son did in primary school. He did about Swain Forkbeard, because I remember when he got home, because we lived near Gainsborough and Swain Forkbeard died in Gainsborough. And Gainsborough was the capital of England when Swain Forkbeard was king. So they made a big deal of it in school. And my son came home, he was about 8 or 9. And I said to him, so when did Swain Forkbeard die? Expecting to get 1014. And I got, when he fell off his horse.
Oh, the innocence of children. He's quite right in some ways, I guess.
Well, Canute was really a mover and shaker, in not just in England, but in Europe. I mean, he went to Rome. He was hanging around with the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope. And I don't think he gets enough credit for how significant he was during the end of his, towards the end of his reign. I mean, his daughter with Emma married the son of the Holy Roman Emperor. And if she had had a child that lived, which she did not, if she had lived longer and had a child, can you imagine the Holy Roman Empire and Denmark and Norway and England? That would have been all one empire. It would have been enormous. And I think Knut had that in mind when he arranged that wedding.
I mean, if we all, and I'm going to explain this to you as well, dear viewers, if you all pause and think, if Emma and Knut had sons and no other sons from no other previous marriages, there was no feuding, no civil war, no political throne swapses, who knows what kind of dynasty they could have founded. It would have been a whole other world. Time and present day would have changed a lot since then, and it's a shame almost that it didn't get to happen, I think. But I'm biased because I like Vikings, so
Arthur Canute didn't marry, and neither did Harald Harefoot, and Edward the Confessor married but might as well not have.
Yeah.
It's odd, there's such a children of the generation just didn't marry or didn't have heirs. It's really strange.
It is. It's tragic. And of course, we don't quite know why Arthur Canute died. I think he died suddenly from an illness of some sort, but we don't quite know what the illness was. Am I right, or am I thinking of something
else?
We don't
know. There's theories that that maybe there was a strain in his genetic line, because his brother died young and his son died young. We just don't know. And his son by Elfgifu died young, and so did Harald Harefoot. So what was that all about? I mean, I suppose if you're writing fiction and you want to you know, tell up an interesting story. You have someone poisoning or, you know, something going on. But the reality is life then was, you know, medical care was not very good. So it could have been, it's just odd that all the children died in their 20s. It's just odd.
What if they had something like a hereditary TB or something?
Yeah, that's what they think. It was some sort of hereditary strain maybe in the... Certainly Sven didn't have it. And Knut lived to be, what, almost 40, I think, something like that. Yeah. I mean, that's young. I mean, Edward the Confessor lived quite a bit longer. So,
unfortunately.
So, not to forget the other candidate that we're discussing about, which is, of course, Harald Hardrada, which everyone knows him by that name, but this wonderful, well, I say wonderful, this series, which is wonderful to some degrees, is telling the wonderful adventures he had before he got the nickname Hardrada, aka Hard Ruler, which he obtained when he became King of Norway. Justin, of course, you've written about him in your much beloved Viking Spirits, one of my favourites, I must say. Could you please give us another wonderful introduction into Harald Sigurdsson's origins and how he became to lose the throne of Norway initially, to a degree?
I think, having spent kind of, you know, Sharon and Patricia will know that when you're researching a novel, you spend a lot of time kind of thinking about the characters, thinking about their motivations, and what and why they did things. And Harald Hardrada, I grew to be more and more interested in him as the story went on. I think actually we talk about Knut being kind of undersold by history and history lessons. I think Harald Hardrada as well. I think he's almost a kind of Renaissance prince before his time. I mean, his career is just extraordinary.
It is.
He's kind of a poet king, and he's a king whose kind of poetry is not famous because he's king. It's famous because his poetry is good. Unfortunately, his poetry is skaldic, which is, you know, it doesn't translate to kind of modern sensibility. So we can't enjoy his poetry in a way that people of his time did. I always like to kind of give the brief introduction to him. He's kind of dragged wounded from battle at the age of 15. He survives. He crosses the Kielbeck Mountains between Norway and Sweden in kind of the face of winter. He makes his way down to the Swedish capital. And kind of Norwegian Vikings would typically come west to Ireland and England. And he's forced, because of Knut, he's forced to go east to take the Russian road. And of course, Russia doesn't exist yet. It's kind of a nascent state in what is now Ukraine and Kiev. But the Russian road is never kind of the easy one. He heads east through these river systems that head down towards Constantinople. He ends up in Constantinople. He ends up the leader of the Varangian Guard, who are the kind of the elite shop troops of the Byzantine Empire. He leads them in the invasion of Sicily. He's, you know, by the side of the emperor in the reconquest of Bulgaria. He's possibly lover to the empress, or he's certainly involved in kind of royal machinations. He's imprisoned. He's set free by a lucky revolt. He escapes eventually from Constantinople, picks up a Russian princess on his way back to Norway. And this is all before he's 30 years old. I mean, he's just the most extraordinary character. And then when he's in Norway, again, he founds Oslo as the capital of Norway. He reforms the Norwegian church. He's probably bringing in Orthodox priests and monks into Norway. And then in 1066, he decides he wants to be King of England as well. So just the most extraordinary character. Mm. And again, I think if you're a betting man, your money would have been on Harald Hardrada winning the, you know, English throne in 1066. Mm. He was by far the most dangerous opponent. He's the only one as a professional soldier. Harald Godwinson and William the Conqueror, their military record was largely skirmishes, whereas Harald Hardrada really was a hard-bitten professional soldier in the kind of crucible of the Mediterranean, fighting all kinds of battles. He survives it all. He gets to England, and Harald Godwinson is very lucky to win at the Battle of Stamford Bridge. So that's, you know, kind of the very quick synopsis.
Well, that's all wonderful. And if you're watching Dear Viewer, whether you've seen season two or season one, that gives you insight and a bit more about what may come potentially in season three, which is slightly exciting because it's an area where many people don't think of when they think of Vikings. Because, of course, in season two, we see Hardrada escape wounded from a battle, not from the battle with Canute. It was a battle with his half-brother Olaf. There you go, right of license. He didn't quite go over any mountains, but he did go with his friend Leif Erikson. Don't ask me why he's involved in this. Again, creative reasons. In a boat, without supplies, without a sail, just them in their furs and two oars, all the way to Yaroslav the Wise in... I've forgotten the name of it.
Kiev.
Remind me.
Yeah.
Novgorod.
Thank you. Both. Both of them. Wherever the Rus is at this point in history. So that was interesting. They missed out that entire wonderful adventure of him even getting to the Rus at all. They just kind of like saw him on a ship and then plonked him in furs and with a bow and arrow.
They also forget that at this point he's a teenager rather than a grown man.
Yes, yes. Both him and Canute are around the same time. Hardrada is younger than Canute. Yeah, which should be the other way.
I think Hardrada should have been a baby in season one.
But yes.
There's that wonderful scene in season one where they go down the waterfall. The ship goes, they've got this huge gnar, this trading ship, and it goes down this waterfall. The waterfall was there. That horrible waterfall, and they had to portage the boats around that waterfall. Mm-hmm. They never would have made it. Going over.
They didn't do a single portage. Where was the portages? I've read so much about boat portages between kind of like the fur trade and the slave trade down all these rivers down to Constantinople. They didn't do any portaging. Mm-hmm. Surely he would have known that because his uncle would have told him, oh yeah, you can't go down there without portaging. Hire a crew and some boats and off you go. But now he decided to eventually, in the fictional telling of this series, he buys a lot of furs and decides he's going to go down to Constantinople as a fur trader and sell all the furs and then buy an army that way. Of course, that didn't happen because he had to bail all the furs out to get the boat over the waterfall. I don't know why they couldn't just put them on the grass, ladies. Why did they have to chuck the furs in the river? I'm sorry if it was like some symbolic unloading, but they should just put the furs on the river. They didn't have to dump them in the river. But anyway. Yes.
I wanted to ask Justin, was Yaroslav his uncle?
In-law.
Yeah.
He was his in-law, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Olaf's sister was Yaroslav's wife.
Yeah. Olaf spends quite a time in Yaroslav's court and then comes back to die at the Battle of Stiklestad.
Yaroslav's wife, Ingegerd, was originally betrothed to Olaf.
Ah.
It broke off, so Olaf ended up marrying her illegitimate half-sister. As with Githa, the relationship is there. But
maybe it's just easier to call them niece and uncle, as they have done.
Well, I don't think that a lot of people realise the connection between, say, the Vikings and the Eastern European regency. For example, Canute's mother was the sister of the King of Poland. So you have that connection, you know, that East-West connection.
When I was writing Silk and the Sword, that was when I discovered how many links there are to Eastern Europe with the Saxons, the Anglo-Saxons and the Danes, because Harald II's daughter marries Yaroslav's, is it son or grandson? Can't remember, Vladimir II monarch now, or whatever his name is. But, you know, there's all these links. And then, of course, Yaroslav's daughter, Anna, marries the King of France. So you've got these East-West links all through the 11th century.
Yeah, and actually the Viking world is far more an Eastern world. I mean, we know it obviously through England and Ireland and Iceland, but you know, far more of the kind of Viking exploration was going down the Eastern, you know, through Russia, what is now modern Russia and Ukraine. And the kind of the amount of silver flooding back into Europe. I mean, there's a kind of theory that
the medieval economy takes off because there's so much silver coming, being brought back by the Vikings, selling slaves into the Middle East, that it just lubricates the whole European economy and changes it fundamentally.
That's one thing I kind of like was slightly pleased to see, and not slightly pleased to see in the sense of that slavery is a bad thing, but that they did acknowledge a small nod to the slave trade that does go down the Dnieper River and the river systems to Constantinople, in that Harold's ship had half of theirs and three Irish red-haired slave girls as well, although sadly not all of them survived that particular river trip. Unfortunately, on the river trip, Netflix does something which I'm quite ashamed of, and that they have a tribe of, well, I say tribe, a group of warriors approach Harold and his rather odd collection of companions on this river ride, and they call them the Rangi, or Varangian. But I'm thinking, oh, that can't be the same Varangian guards that they're going to meet in Constantinople, surely. So I'm hoping that that's just some creative licensing, because surely there weren't other people known as Varangians there, or is that where the Varangian guards came from, that they came from a certain collection of men or that have chimed in?
I think more like French Foreign Legion, weren't they? They came from everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, they changed that. I think they're originally a kind of a Viking force, and it's not really sure where the name comes from. I think there is the kind of one of the most likely theories is that it comes from the word for vow, which is kind of Varang. So they're kind of warriors held together by a vow. I think they were probably, I'm trying to think if that would mean they're Varangians before they actually get to Constantinople. I don't think so. But when they're in Constantinople, that's probably the name they're known by. And of course, Sharon's right, they are kind of a French Foreign Legion-esque, largely Viking in the time of Harald Hardrada, but after the Battle of Hastings, a lot of English Huscarls, flee England and end up fighting in the Varangian Guard. It becomes very English.
Interesting.
Yeah, and there's still, I think it's still part of Istanbul. It has a name that that refers in some way to the English. So very interesting.
I love the story. We're not there yet. I'm hoping they do put it in the next one of Harold escaping. Sorry, of Harold escaping from Constantinople in a ship, and he actually there's a chain across the harbour.
Yes, is that a real thing? Then did that really happen, or was I wasn't entirely sure whether to believe it or not when I first read about it.
It's in the saga.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily true, but you want it to be, because the idea of making a ship jump.
He's done so much by that point, it's believable, really.
Well, the chain was real, wasn't it? They did have that chain.
They did have the chain, yeah.
Yeah, if you can see it in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. They have a link from it. So I think it probably is true.
He must have done it somehow, because they wouldn't have released the chain for him, so he must have got over some kind of seesaw motion, maybe, to get over, wait for a high tide,
high speed rowing to rise the ship up and then crash back down again.
Well, they did a good job of showing Olaf pull down the London Bridge, so hopefully they'll do the same.
They just got loads of people with axes recently constructed. Just to rewind a bit, when Harald Sigurdsson got to his uncle Yaroslav, he, in the series, it seems like quite a brief stay, but he did stay for some years, did he not? Did he not serve in the military there?
Years, I think. Yeah,
yeah, it's hard to say.
Yaroslav as well. He went to war with Yaroslav.
Yeah, I think he leaves Norway when he's like 15 years old, so he's bound to have, just kind of grow into a man and establish his own reputation as a kind of a warlord. I would say kind of 4 or 5 years. And in that time, he is in the fur trade, and it's kind of all the tribes, the Livs, what's now Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia, they're all pagan. And I think basically the Vikings are extorting tribute out of them, which is, kind of brutal and warlike, and uses threat and intimidation to get furs out of people. That's how they made their money. Yeah.
In the series as well, they've also introduced the Peshnags, which of course are seen as like the big obstacle blocking trade going up and down the river. And in the series, you have the Slav says, oh, no one's going down to Constantinople because the Peshnags are causing trouble again. He doesn't outright ask Hadrada to solve it. Hadrada just happens to stumble into a very equally confusing, convoluted plot involving meeting one of the Peshnags, kind of like warlords, and hung by his chest with hooks from some ropes. I don't know why the writers put that in, ladies. That was just... I'm like, yes, we know he's a tough, strong Viking. He really didn't need to boast about it and then get put to the test, but he did in the script. Did you kind of like learn through your research and obviously writing the book how much of a trouble the Peshnags were and how much Harold had to help in any military campaigns to control them, stop them taking control of the riverways or anything like that?
Yeah, the Peshnags were a Turkic horse-mounted people who lived in the steppes. And they were absolutely terrifying, I think, to the Vikings because they employ, much like the Huns, a kind of nomadic way of battle. But the Vikings were not particularly suited to fighting at all. And so we're talking about the portages, and the portages where... The Russian rivers don't meet up, I think the Don and the Volga are 70 kilometers apart, and they're now linked by a canal. But in Viking times, if you wanted to cross between those two river systems, you'd have to, drag your boat out. And then there were established portages where you would, basically drag your boat or have teams of people that you pay to drag your boat across. And the Peshnag were, mounted, group who would prey on those Vikings or those groups and plunder them. Yaroslav's grandfather, I think, had gone to battle with the Peshnags and lost. And there's a story about how the Peshnag king used his skull, had it plated in gold, and used it as a drinking vessel. So they were, they're terrifying people. And again, I think there's remains in Ukraine of kind of ramparts and bulwarks that were built during this time. They have a name and I can't remember what it is now, but clearly Yaroslav was attempting to kind of define, one of the great problems of this kind of this area of Europe is that there's no natural barriers, and so this is why there's been so many kind of wars that spread between Russia and Poland, because it's very hard to define a natural barrier. And clearly Yaroslav was attempting to define kind of his civilized state from the nomadic areas of the Peshnags.
Well, you'd be pleased to know that they do use skulls in Harold's encounter with the Peshnags. The warlord sat on a throne made of skulls, all intricately carved. I don't know how they managed that without breaking the skull bone, but there we go. And Hadrada in the script boasts that, you don't have a Viking skull because the Viking would be drinking your skull, blah, 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 blah. Very bravado. Very full of bravado. So when, of course, Hadrada does get down the river, he survives military training with Yaroslav and the Peshnags, and he gets to Constantinople, does he outright automatically sign up to the ranking guard? Does he have to do any training with them before he gets that title? Because I was never sure how quickly or smoothly he became, because he got to quite high rank, did he not, in the ranking guard, Justin?
Yeah, he leads 1,000 Varangians in the reconquest of Sicily. It's kind of hard to know. There's the saga is a little confused and it kind of mixes dates. But there's enough kind of veracity in it to I think historians assume that his kind of the Varangian Guard did many different things for the Byzantines. And so probably his first roles would be as kind of shock troops on boats or kind of the navy who were kind of clearing Muslim pirates out of kind of the Greek islands, essentially. And I think, his career is just as a professional soldier. He, he has the advantage of having royal birth, which would have, certainly helped him along within the Varangians, who are mostly Vikings, and success in battle. He was he was a big guy, you know, he's kind of rumored to be 6 foot tall, and he gets, you know, 6 foot of ground from Harold Godwinson. So he's a big guy with of royal birth who's successful and charismatic, and he, you know, slowly rises up, I think, through, you know, success and example. And so in the reconquest of Sicily, he's leading 1,000, and that's the you know, the killer shock troops of the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, essentially.
I remember right, didn't they say something like he fought 30 or 40 battles as a Varangian?
Yeah.
Just in his time in the Varangian Guard. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and to survive them.
Yeah, you would have thought after 20, you'd have defeated everyone that there was to defeat. But
yeah, and he's obviously taken plunder. And I think you had to, you know, he gets later accused of not giving enough plunder to the Byzantine emperor. And he's squirreling away up the river system to Yaroslav.
He does, that's right.
When he returns to Norway, the sagas say something like, you know, he was the richest king of Christendom. You know, he is, you know, extraordinarily rich. He basically kind of buys Norway off, you know, off Magnus, or half of Norway off Magnus, his nephew. So he's, you know, obviously incredibly successful. He's squirreling away a fortune, you know, away from the Byzantine emperor, and, you know, and rising. It's why I kind of say he's by far the most dangerous threat to England in 1066, because he is a professional soldier in a time when, in northern Europe, there aren't really professional soldiers in a way that there are in the south, because there are so much more battles to fight.
That's interesting. Well,
yeah, in season two, training for King Harold II was to attack Wales.
Yeah.
Harold Hardrada has been fighting in the Varangian Guard for years, and Harold II had a couple of seasons in Wales.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Did Harold die at Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, he did.
It was one of the ones that died. Yeah.
I drove through it actually on Sunday on the way to my son's rugby match, and I was thinking about it. So he fights the Battle of Fulford Gate, which is kind of just south of York, and he defeats the Earls of Mercia and Northumbria. And then essentially the kind of the north of England promised to meet him a week later and, you know, and swear fealty. So he moves kind of a day's march east of York, and a third of his army is down with the ships on the Humber or the Ouse, and the other two thirds are essentially kind of feasting and you know, relaxing. And Harold Godwinson catches them unawares and unarmored. So it's the army that he brings back with him, the professional soldiers he brings back from Norway to Norway, are there at Stamford Bridge, and, you know, get slaughtered largely because they don't have their armour or their army. And so Harold Godwinson was extremely lucky. And the battle goes on. We have the extraordinary thing of kind of two battles that go on all day long. And Stamford Bridge is one of them. And again, inflicts such a huge toll on Harold Godwinson's army that it neuters him hugely for the Battle of Hastings, which is kind of a month later.
Harold Godwinson did an amazing march with all of his men up the country and then back down the country again. I don't know how they kept up the pace or the speed, but they must have just not stopped, basically.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them would have been kind of local troops, so he'll have a coterie of kind of loyal men to him, and then the rest will be kind of local troops he picks up on the way. Extraordinary period of history.
It is. I mean, like with the scenario of kind of like, what if Emperor Canute had lived happily ever after and that lineage had carried on, that year, as they say, is a pivotal year, because England could have been stayed the same or gone Denmark or gone to, well, it did go to Normandy in the end, but so yeah, it's a lot of what ifs. In season two, we do meet, I'm guessing, possibly the potential Empress Zoe, although she's known as Eleanor. Am I right, ladies, in thinking that was her name before she was presented to the Emperor? Because in the final episode, the Emperor actually meets Harold and his crew of odd ones on their ship whilst they're trying to build a sail, because they had to get rid of the sail when they went down the waterfall, as you do. And he goes, oh yes, you've got something precious for me. And of course Harold doesn't realize it's the girl wearing the amulet. He thinks it's just the amulet, but no, it's the girl. She's the bride. Ta-da! She's the new empress. And she's like, oh, don't worry. I know you love me really, but I can now give you the army you always want kind of thing.
She wouldn't have been with Harold for Harold to bring her to Constantinople. She was already in Constantinople.
Yeah.
You know, she was born and grew up there. She was the empress. The emperor wasn't the emperor until he married her. She was the one with the right to the throne and not him. Yeah. So it's like, that was just like, I was trying to work out what on earth was going on.
Yeah, a big lot of romantic drama there for you viewers. Just a big dramatic drama, not true.
Well, it's also annoying because the misogyny of it. The bloke had to be the emperor and they were bringing the girl to him. And it's like, well, it was the other way around in this case.
When you have an example of history of kind of, you know, a strong, independent woman.
Yeah.
Why change that? Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Justin, you've opened a can of worms, because my one beef with this series is not with Emma's depiction, Godwin's or Hardrada's, is the fact they had an amazing Arabic scholar who was a woman, and of course the poor thing died of cancer on the boat trip. They couldn't just have her survive and help Leif Erikson continue his great Arabic studies. He learned Arabic in the entire boat trip down. Don't ask me how, he just did. Yeah. He learned how to use a compass and a sundial and everything. But she, I liked her because she was intelligent and brave and was happy to get nitty and gritty when it came to a fight kind of thing. And of course, they had to just make Leif more unhappy by taking her away from him. So that's the second woman Leif Erikson has lost. I'm just saying that. He's lost a pagan and now a Christian. I don't know if he's going to go, well, not Christian, a Muslim. Sorry. She was a Muslim, I think. So, creative license. It's good, but it can also be bad. Especially when it's dealing with history. Says,
when you have a powerful woman like Zoe, why take away her power? Why not actually have her be Empress Zoe? Give, you know, it's just like,
yeah, it would have been interesting to see like a powerful figure toy with him like that, kind of like saying, oh, I like you, but I don't like you because I'm Empress, that kind of thing.
She was also much older than him. I think she was,
she was
past childbearing age, so
she was about 60, wasn't she, at the time when she married her second husband? And there are rumours that he helped kill her first husband.
Yeah.
I was going to say, he got involved in a lot of kind of like emperor disposition, because didn't he have to help blind two of them? Either side of Zoe, or was it after Zoe? I can't remember which way around it was.
Yeah,
I
can't remember. So Michael IV was killed in the bath.
Oh. Dramatic.
So Zoe marries his nickname, the Corker. Because his family come from, he's a the chief eunuch in the palace. He has a handsome young nephew, and he's nicknamed the Corker because his family are from a shipbuilding family. And he brings his nephew into the palace, and he gets the attention of Empress Zoe, who then marries him. And then he staged a palace coup.
And then he sends her to a nunnery, doesn't he?
Yeah, shaves her head, sends her to a nunnery, and then tries to marry someone else. And this is when Harold Hardrada's kind of, you know, moment comes, because Harold has been imprisoned at this point. The sagas tell us that his brother, the, you know, now Saint Olaf, comes to him in a dream. Or is there a dream of a snake? I forget exactly now. But there's some kind of story, and Harold is kind of, you know, is saved. But clear that there's a palace coup, and some of the the saga tells us that a palace woman comes to where Harold is imprisoned, because it's not really a dungeon; it's a kind of a barracks, really, and sets him free. And Harold then helps lead the kind of the storming of the palace. It's kind of coming back to me as I'm talking. So when the palace coup happens, the Varangians are replaced in the palace by a force of Pechenegh kind of children, And so the Varangians are kind of upset and unhappy. They're, you know, they've been kind of excluded. And so naturally they turn to Harald Hardrada, who then becomes their leader. And the Varangians essentially storm the palace, free the empress from the monastery. And then the saga doesn't tell us what exactly happened. It tells us that the emperor is blinded. The emperor flees to a monastery to seek sanctuary, and he's dragged out of the monastery and blinded. And it doesn't say Harald Hardrada is that person, but I think he probably was. And so, yeah, again, you know, in terms of a kind of Norwegian adventurer, he is the power broker. He put Zoe back on the throne, and, you know, blinds the emperor. So he, you know, again, kind of extraordinary power that he's wielding. But then, just imagine the next emperor who marries Zoe. The Byzantine aristocracy decide, okay, we can't let Zoe pick, next handsome husband. We have to pick one of our own to marry her, and just kind of destabilize the state. And that emperor clearly finds Harald a little disconcerting, knowing what he did to the previous emperor. And so Harald's time is quite short.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful recap, because he has so many adventures just wherever he goes, like just even his escape from Stiklestad is one adventure, and they kind of nod to it in the end of season one with him fleeing with the aid of another fictional, well, not fiction, entirely fictional, Leif Erikson's sister. He nearly has his happy,
she
kind of like happy
well.
End. Yeah, there's all sorts going on here. The fact that they've got Godwin as the villain is the real, as well, there's lots of untruths mixed with slight truths, mixed with a lot of fiction, and just generally a lot of spicy drama, basically. But yes.
It's enjoyable to watch, but I spend most of my time going, no!
Yeah.
And that's not it. He's not there. She's not there.
He's too old.
I think it's where Game of Thrones was so successful, in that it didn't go for kind of easy tropes. And it did kind of play those interesting, you know, parallels of kind of powerful women, older powerful women, and the kind of how they use their power and the way they exert their power. I thought in a much more interesting way. And again, I always think with the history is always so interesting. If you just stuck to the history, you need a much more interesting story.
Mm-hmm. I think what they did with Vikings Valhalla is I wonder if they thought they were only going to get one season out of it. So they tried to get everybody in the first season, which is why you end up with Swain Forkbeard living after he's dead, and Canute calling Edmund a boy when they're exactly the same age.
Yes.
And I just wonder if they just thought they'd get this one season, so we'd better have everybody in it. And then it was, oh, we've got another season. So although we did have Harald Hardrada already in it, when he was only a baby at the time, we want him in this one because he's near. We keep in St. Olaf, even though he would be dead if Harald's age, but he isn't because we haven't actually got to the point where he's supposed to be dead yet.
I sometimes wonder too if whoever was writing season two had actually seen season one. Because, for example, the character of Emma is completely different in season two than she was in season one. She's and of course they've totally, you know, changed her personality and her character and have her do things that she never would have done.
She would not have solid her hands with that.
No. And she would.
And the idea of torturing a woman anyway was just it would have been abhorrent to them.
Well, you know, part of it is the minutiae of running a kingdom is not terribly interesting. And so if you're doing a drama, and Vikings Valhalla is aimed towards an audience that wants blood and swords. And so you have to figure out how to, how to address that. And so the story that they make up does that. But
yeah. This is what the writers should have done. They should have just made one season about the whole Ethelred versus Swein Forkbeard and Edmund versus Canute, with a lovely conclusion, like in your wonderful series, Patricia, with just Emma Mancanutin having a happy ending at the end. And then they should find another series entirely about Harada from his teenage exile all the way through to 1066, because he deserves a whole series by himself covering every year.
Yes, that would be wonderful. You know, have one season that's just England and what's going on there, and then have another one that just looks at what the Vikings are up to. And you know, Harald Hardrada is so fascinating.
That's true, actually. And then you could have a third one in Normandy.
Yeah, exactly.
And you could do it like that.
Because then you have your third series with Edward the Confessor coming over, and then you lead into 1066. There you go. Netflix, hire us. We'll write it for you.
We'll write it.
And with these two authors, it will be wonderful. It really would, because I enjoyed all your books, guys. I mean, it's what helped me fall in love with these characters even more. And of course, I'm a history nerd, so of course, as soon as I read your books, I wanted to read the non-fiction to find, oh, that really happened, and oh, they did do this, and that really happened. And this is why I'm hoping our discussion has enlightened our viewers somewhat, because whether they've seen season one or season two, or both, or haven't yet, we're helping you go in with understanding there is a lot of salt involved, but there is some nuggets of truth hidden in there. You just need to unweave it and then weave it back together again, knowing what you've done.
I did a talk at the school in October after Vikings Valhalla came out, and I was talking to this school. It was an all-girls school. And I said, right, the first thing, who's watched Vikings Valhalla? Forget it. It's not ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's a shame that Emma is depicted the way she is and that Godwin is depicted the way he is. Hardrada at the moment is basically a lone wolf heartthrob because he's got no band of warriors. He's shown no great military skill yet, ladies, has he? Not really, in any extent, no. So it's going to be interesting to see how they depict him being worthy of joining the Varangian Guard when he gets there, besides just giving him a royal title. But that is where season three will be. It will be set at Constantinople, which, of course, as we've said, is an area that the Vikings did go to, kind of like they did do slave trade over that way. And they've got dirham coins coming back here. So it's hopefully going to enlighten a little bit more to the modern audience that Vikings went all over the world. They haven't been to the moon, but they basically went all over apart from Arctic and Antarctic. But yes, so that's it. I don't think I've got any more questions. Have you got any more questions or points you want to discuss or raise?
I do want to, you know, I'm very curious about what they're going to do with Leif Erikson, because his name is the best known probably of all this group among the general population. And they have him in a place where he never was. And I'm wondering if they're ever going to send him to North America now that he's learned how to use an astrolabe. I'm very curious to see what they're going to do with Leif.
It's clearly a possible kind of future series extension.
Because right now he's in Constantinople.
Yes, he's gone along the whole way. He's going backwards. He's going east instead of west. He's not even hit Iceland or Greenland yet. So, well, he came from Greenland, so he's come even.
Becky, you talk about how the Vikings went everywhere. Yeah, you can. If you ever go to Istanbul, you go to the Hagia Sophia. There's, which is the huge church, the Justinian's 6th-century church he built. Just extraordinary building with, you know, huge dome. And there's.
I think it's the Al-Aqsa Mosque now, isn't it? Because isn't it one of the buildings?
It used to be a museum, and then it's a
museum now.
I'm thinking of one of the other buildings then, because that used to be a church, and now it's a mosque.
So there's the Blue Mosque, and then across is the Hagia Sophia, which I think, it was made back into a mosque about 2 years ago. So I was in Greece at the time, and there were a lot of very angry Greeks. Anyway, there's Viking graffiti in there. So you can imagine some, you know, bored Vikings, you know, chiseling their name. I think it's Halfdan. Halfdan is one of the names that's been carved into the stone there. So, you know, the Vikings are everywhere. Extraordinary. And of course, they were into Iran as well. There's a lot of, you know, Arabic dirhams has been found in Sweden. So incredible stories. And I think... in a sense, the kind of the stereotype of the Vikings as kind of, you know, hairy, horned, helmeted, you know, folks doesn't do them justice. They were kind of transnational and they formed the kind of the modern world in a way that our history lessons, which are obsessed with the Tudors and the Second World War and the Nazis, you know, utterly kind of disregard. And I think, you know, an extraordinary story to be told, you know, stick to the facts. You know, the facts are very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I enjoyed learning about Elizabeth I, when I learned about Emma, I was like, forget Elizabeth. Emma's doing it before Elizabeth was even around. And she did it with men around her.
And guess who? The one who married Godwin. She was incredible. She was a really strong, powerful woman all the way through the 1066 period. You know, she was still raising rebellion in 1068.
But she gave birth to 9 kids, for crying out loud, in the 11th century. Holy cow.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope they bring her into it properly and tell some of her story, because she was an incredible woman. When I wrote my Silk and the Sword about the women of the Norman Conquest, it was like I expected Emma to steal the show. And then I started researching Githa. And it was like, it took me days to write her story. She's the longest chapter in the book. And I used to come downstairs going, right, I'm going to finish Githa today. And it took me 3 days to finish her, because she's like something like 12,000 words long. Because she's there all the way through, right to past 1066. She is, you know, she's in every single part of the story.
And all her children survived adulthood. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. As we know.
It is, considering, as we've just been discussing, kind of like how many different lineages all died out because their sons all died young, without marriage or without heirs of their own.
Well, she's the one, it's her descendants who still sit on our throne. You know, because it's from her granddaughter, who married the Kievan prince, that came back into the English bloodline with Philippa of Hainault. And ever since, it's her bloodline that's on the throne.
Yeah, because I think, isn't it, Harold Godwinson is a Orthodox saint. Or is it Edmund? I forget.
Edward the Martyr. Edward the Martyr, Ethelred's older brother. He's an Orthodox saint.
Yeah.
And I still haven't found out why.
Because he was martyred.
Yeah.
And he's buried in the Orthodox cemetery on the outskirts of London, because the English and Roman Catholic churches couldn't decide who could have him, so the Romans took him.
Oh, blimey. Here's a question. Is Hardrada buried, I'm guessing, in Norway then?
So I think it was originally buried in York Minster and then repatriated. And it was very interesting when Richard III was found under the car park in Leicester. I was doing a series of talks on Harald Hardrada, and something very similar appears to be the case for Harald Hardrada. I can't remember exactly where he was buried, but wherever it was kind of an abbey that was dissolved during the Reformation and is now a stretch of road. I have a kind of photo somewhere, a stretch of road in Oslo. So he's kind of under that stretch of road. But fascinatingly, I went to the ninth. So when I first came back to England from Hong Kong, it was just the 950th anniversary of 1066. So I was kind of at all the battlefields. And when I went to the Stamford Bridge, which is kind of my local battlefield, someone said, Harald Hardrada's descendant is going to be there. And I was so excited. I was kind of both excited and terrified. And I was terrified because I thought, just imagine if he's kind of, you know, a weedy little, accountant, you know. And I turned up and... this guy, I was just so happy. I mean, he's from Iceland, and obviously in Iceland they had nothing to do for 1,000 years, but kind of trace their genealogy. And he's, you know, I'm sure everyone in Iceland is descended from everyone, but he has this huge sheet of paper, which, you know, he's descended from Egil Skallagrimsson, the great poet, you know, every Icelandic person he can trace his ancestry to. And one of them is Harald Hardrada. And his name was, what was he? Olaf Viking Sigurdsson, I think he goes by, and he was kind of 6'4". He was he was wider than, you know, my arm span, and he told me, and he had a kind of big kind of shaggy red blonde beard, and he said that his he had been a bodyguard at the Helsinki summit between Gorbachev and Reagan, and his grandfather had been Mr. Universe. And he'd done something in the Berlin Olympics. I can't remember what, but he was just a giant of a man, and I was so happy and so excited.
Oh, wow.
That's a wonderful
story. If he hadn't been, you'd have said, are you sure?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have a photo with him, and I'm 6 foot, and I look like a midget next time. I look like a child. It was just great. I was so happy. And he was lovely.
Oh. Well, of course, we know Emma and Canute's bones, and half Canute's bones are in little caskets, aren't they, at Windsor Cathedral? Yes, yeah. And they were going under some scientific research or analysis a few years ago, definitely before the pandemic.
I think they've identified Emma's, because she's the only woman.
Yes.
So they've identified Emma's, because there is only one woman, and it's her, so they must be Emma's.
Yeah.
The others are a bit harder to do.
Yeah, they all got mixed up during the English Civil War, when I think the parliamentarians, was it, that threw rocks through the window and knocked all the caskets over, and some poor soul decided, oh, this bone will go in that box, and that bone in that box, and hope for the best.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'd be wonderful if they could put their full skeletons on display and tell more about their connection, really, with Winchester, because it was their base for a good many years during their reign.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Queen of England twice. I'd like to remind everyone, twice.
It's really too bad that her skull is not intact, because they can't do a reconstruction, you know, like they've done with some of the other characters from history.
Yeah. It's a shame.
Well, in terms of season 3 of Vikings Valhalla, we know they're definitely going to be in Constantinople. We discussed and learned, therefore, that Elena may get her name changed to Zoe, but she won't be living the life of the real Zoe in any way, shape or form, unless Hardrada helps her get rid of her husband by pulling a coup and poking out his eyes. Spoilers, it might happen. We don't know what the writers are going to do. They might do some craziness. Who knows? We know, of course, that Emma is dealing with Lady Macbeth Tal guilt. Godwin is married to Geatha, so whether he does any more manipulation and wickedness behind the scenes, who knows? Canute is back in England after dealing with the Wends. Did he have to deal with the Wends? Were they really a problem for him at any point? Yeah. Oh, they were. Yeah. That's at least true, then. That's at least true. Because I'm assuming, with the Wends bothering Norway, is that when he went? Oh no, he went to Denmark, didn't he? He went to Denmark to deal with the Wends.
Running Denmark, because, I think.
Yes, because was that after his brother Harald died and he claimed Denmark? Yeah, because that's one thing as well the series have missed off. They've missed off that he had multiple crowns and thrones going all over the shop. Because they've just said, oh, he's come over and taken over England and that's it. He's not really focused. Plus, we've got Swain Forkbeard to eventually possibly kill off in season 3. Who knows? We haven't really seen him in season 2, have we? Oh, no, we just seen him in season 2.
A couple of times.
He did that son swap, didn't he, with Olaf. Yeah. So he's got Magnus, who will eventually indeed take the throne of Norway, because Sven and Ylgif will get kicked out because no one likes them anymore. Again, spoilers. I'm just telling you the truth, people. Just telling you the truth, so you're prepared for when it's not the truth. So then you can feel our frustration when everything goes wrong. And of course, the randomness of Leif Erikson, and if he ever stops going west and ever starts heading back east, and how long that'll take him, because he's so far away from everything.
I just wonder why on earth they decided to put Leif in it. Why didn't they just have a Viking, you know, a fictional character, rather than somebody who was doing something totally different at the time? It just seems a daft thing to do.
I think because he's so well known that they said, you know, they took all these well-known Vikings and put them in a pot and stirred it up and said, there's the story.
We've added some extra spice. Because, of course, Leif Erikson is more well known in America than he is in the UK, because, of course, he did find America 500 years before Columbus did, or well, not 500 years, so many hundreds of years before Columbus did. I'm wondering if maybe they had to have him meet up with the lovely Arab scholar that they then killed off to help have him more, be more clever and have more abilities in order to find that way. Because of course the Vikings would have known of Iceland, and of course he was from Greenland. At the time of the series, presumably his character didn't know or think of lands any further west. So that's why he's now got his dialy thingy and his compass and his map reading skills and stuff. That's my current theory. So then they can all say, yes, he did find us because he did this, this and this and this, and then he found us all on the other side of the world kind of thing. But that could have been a whole series in itself, because it would have been nice to see Viking life in Iceland and Viking life in Greenland, because again, people are vaguely aware of them, but not often. Vikings, as a modern sense, do tend to focus on England and Europe, and that's it. We're like in the middle. No one thinks of looking east, it's what they did. No one thinks of looking that far west, it's what they did.
Well, and Leif's sister went to North America too. She did. And so what the heck she's doing over in wherever they've got her in this story.
Jomsburg with the Joms Vikings, which was another very confusing plot line. It didn't make any sense.
But she only receives a couple of sentences in the sagas. You know, she's mentioned in a couple of them. But she'd be an interesting character to actually take a look at what she might have actually done, because she was a voyager.
Yeah, they've made her a bit of a kind of like a pagan religious saint slash advocate.
Yeah.
Almost like an
Well, she's a foil for Olaf. She's holding up.
Yes, they finally had their big climax.
Yeah.
I must admit, his death I found slightly disappointing. I thought being skewered on a spear through the armpits wasn't a great epic death. I wanted to see more bloody injuries to him, or maybe his head lopped off. I don't know.
Well, but, and he died in Norway, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah,
because
we're quite
this is the thing.
There was a solar eclipse during the battle. The saga says there was a solar eclipse during the battle. And we know from, you know, historical records that, you know, there was a solar eclipse. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, this battle is taking place and a solar eclipse. And I was in Prague for there's a solar eclipse in 1999, I think, in Europe. And it was so kind of chilling because, you know, the birds will go silent and you can feel the silence, and the day starts to go dark and cold and it started to rain, you know. So this happens during the battle. An extraordinary kind of coming again, you know, Harald Hardrada is there and, you know, survives it. Fascinating.
Yes. And this is the thing, I think, they're confused in the series. I'm sure there was another Olaf involved in pulling down. Yeah, because there was Olaf the Tall.
King of Sweden was Olaf.
Yes, Olaf. And then there was Olaf the... Oh, I'm thinking of Thorkel.
No. Olaf was king of Sweden and Olaf was king of Norway.
Sorry. I was getting confused. I was getting their version of Olaf confused with Thorkel the Tall, because he did help in terms of London Bridge and Emma and Canute thing. But of course, in the series, this very fictionalized series, it's very confusing. I'm picking all this. Their Olaf is both alive and not alive at the same time. Anyway, gosh, we have talked about so much, and I hope, dear viewers, you managed to keep up with this roller coaster of a ride through history and the wonderful characters involved. I know we focused on three, but we've pretty much picked out the entire cast, because they all impact on each other. No man is an island, and indeed in this great period of time, all these players move and interact with each other and betray each other or marry each other or fall in love and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, but I really do appreciate your time joining me for this wonderful talk. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have, as you can tell by my big grin. and your knowledge and insight has been really helpful and insightful. And I've learned things, again, that I might have forgotten or didn't know before now. And definitely seeing the series in a different light, but hopefully we'll have more to talk come season three, which may come out next year. Who knows? I know they're kind of like, they gave a sneak peek trailer and showed Harald in some very almost like gold Romanesque type armor looking out over a sunny balcony over a nice blue sea. And I was thinking, oh, I don't know about that armor, but we'll see. we'll see. So we've got lots to go for. But yes, thank you so much for your time, Patricia. Thank you so much for your time, Justin. And of course, thank you so much, Sharon Bennett Connolly. Her lovely book, The Silk...
Silk and the Sword.
Silk and the Sword. I was going to say The Silk and the Steel. I was getting yours and Patricia's book.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's why I couldn't use Silk and the Steel and Silk and Steel, isn't it?
But yes, do, dear viewers, do go up these lovely authors and writers and historians. They've written some wonderful books, and it really will help you learn the real history, what Netflix is adapting and retelling and rewriting in ways more than one, because the real history, as you said, is a lot better. And I will end on the quote that I knew I was going to find at the start and didn't read out. So I will do that now. Where is it? It was this one. Would you mind reading it for me, Patricia, because my email's failing me.
It's from Hilary Mantel. And the quote is, "As soon as we die, we enter into fiction. Once we can no longer speak for ourselves, we are interpreted."
Brilliant. I think that sums up beautifully what my aim was with this whole discussion, ultimately. And it reflects as well what Netflix are doing, because basically no one can repute them, no one can tell them that wasn't true. We can only do what the records say, and there's only so many records, and even then the records have their own biases and problems and just lack of sometimes. There are gaps which you wonderful authors fill in beautifully, and sometimes TV series writers don't fill in beautifully. to a degree. It's all a pinch of salt, So thank you, dear viewers, for spending time with us. Thank you, dear panellists, for spending time with me and putting up with my questions and over eagerness and excitement. And hopefully we can reunite for season 3 when it comes out at some point in the future. But thank you very much for watching.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.